for the introduction and for the invitation. So today I want to give a brief review of some recent excitements in our field carried out by many of us in the community. So let me begin by saying that one of the grand challenges in quantum condensed matter physics is to understand the effect of interactions in many-body systems. So microscopically, this could be the interacting electrons in a piece of solid or interacting atoms in the optical lattice, in the cold atom setting. So very roughly, there are two regimes. So the easier regime is the where the effect of interaction is weak. So we can basically start with the non-interacting pictures where the particles don't talk to each other and we solve that problem. And then we add the effect of interaction order by order under the name of perturbation theory. For some materials, that works amazingly well, for example, for alkaline metals. But then there's the opposite regime, where the effect of interaction is so strong that a non-interacting picture is not even the right point to start with. Right? Perturbation theory doesn't work. The famous examples include high-temperature superconductors or fractional quantum Hall effects. You probably have seen this plot somewhere. And for this kind of problems, we really need more non-perturbative tools. And it's fair to say that there's no single tool that there probably won't be a single tool that solves every single thing. So the more tools we have, the better. So one tool that we have been exploring in the past few years is called duality. So the idea is very simple. So if I don't know how to solve a strongly interacting system, it's too hard. Let me try to solve a different problem. And if I got lucky, then sometimes these two different problems, even though microscopically they look very different, end up having the same solution in the sense that if I look at low energy and long distance, they have the same universal physics. So in this sense, you can view this duality as a basically a non-trivial change of variables from one system to another. And the virtue of this is sometimes the problem gets very much simplified under the mapping. In the most lucky scenario, a strongly interacting problem maps to a weakly interacting problem, and then we can just solve it. Sometimes that's too much to ask. Both problems are strongly interacting. Both are hard. But certain questions are much easier to address in one picture than the other. So we gain some better understanding. Okay. And this line of thinking has been proved fruitful in both condensed matter physics and high energy quantum field theories, or even string theory. In both communities, this has a rich history dating back many decades ago. For example, the 2D Ising model is most easily solved by mapping it to some free fermion problem. So in the past 3 years, what made us extremely excited about the story of duality is that through the duality line of thinking, we realized that many previously very different topics in modern condensed matter physics become secretly related in some deep way. So these are topics as diverse as, let's say, topological insulators, fractional quantum Hall effects, quantum spin liquids. These are a class of exotic quantum magnets where quantum fluctuation dominates. Also a certain class of quantum phase transitions. So my plan today is to give you a sampling of some of these connections, to give you an idea what kind of problems we can hopefully tackle with this enhanced tool set. Okay. So let me motivate a little bit more with some detailed questions that turns out we can address. So this is a crash course on fractional quantum Hall effect. So consider a two-dimensional electron gas. Let's say I have a semiconductor where the electrons are confined to move in only in a two-dimensional plane. But under a large magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. Okay. And let me consider regimes where the filling fraction, defined as the ratio between the electron density and the magnetic field strength, is some nice fraction, like one-third or two or five-half, and so on. So in these regimes, the system enters into what's called fractional quantum Hall state. There are many interesting properties of this kind of states. The most amazing one is probably the fact that if I look at the collective motion of this electron soup, it behaves as if the electrons split into fractional excitations. For example, for the simplest state, the electrons behave as if it splits into three identical particles. Each one carries 1/3 of the electron charge. Furthermore, it carries what's called anionic statistics. So it's neither bosonic nor fermionic. It's something in between. So this is an excellent example of emergence of a many-body system. Because if you take a single electron, it never does that. Take your standard model, Lagrangian. It's disallowed for an electron to split into even smaller particles. But when they behave, when they move as in collective manners, this kind of behavior emerges. Okay. And once I allow the electrons to split into several different particles, it's kind of obvious that immediately there are infinitely many possibilities. I can split into three, I can split into five, and so on. So there are many different patterns of electron splitting. And each different pattern, we call it a distinct topological order. Okay? So if you look at this diagram, each plateau in the Hall conductance represent a different topological order. And at low energy, they are described by essentially some kind of topological quantum field theory that's related to other fields in physics. And the simplest measurable signature of this topological order is the famous quantized Hall conductance. If I measure the Hall conductance, you know, I always get some nice number, like 1/3 for this one, and 5/2 for this one. Okay. So then there is the old puzzle of the exact nature of the topological order at a specific feeling fraction, namely 5/5. Okay. It's interesting. It's very interesting, partly because it's a promising host of what's called a non-abelian topological order. So this is a special kind of topological order that may be helpful for, let's say, quantum computing. And there are actually many candidate topological orders, many different ways the electrons split. In these systems, the most popular ones, popular from both theoretical study and numerical simulation, are called the Pfaffian state or the anti-Pfaffian state. They're just some names proposed by these authors. Okay, one can ask, how do I tell them apart? Well, they have some experimental consequence, not from the Hall conductance. They have the same Hall conductance, but they have completely different thermal Hall conductance. So this is defined, let's say, if I put a temperature gradient in one direction and I measure the heat flow in the perpendicular direction. The coefficient is called the thermal Hall conductance, and it's expressed in some natural unit this way. T is the temperature, the others are natural constants. So for this Pfaffian state, the prediction is that I'll get some thermal Hall conductance 7/2. And for the anti-Pfaffian, the prediction is I get 3/2. And this is unlike the usual electric Hall conductance, the thermal Hall conductance is extremely hard to measure. The electric Hall conductance was measured in the 80s, but the thermal Hall was measured finally last year in this heroic paper. And this is the result. You look at the number, it's 5/2, roughly. And it's just different from either of these predictions.
That doesn't look like a measurement. It doesn't have error bars.
Right, so it actually comes with a significant error bar. I think the error bar is of order 0.1.
Okay, so it's not consistent with
error. No. Even from theory, you don't expect the quantization to be as amazing as the electric quantization, Hall conductance quantization, where you get 10 digits or something. Here, you get one digit. It's decent enough for reasons that are partially understood. Just thermal noise are just more severe. Okay. So that's one motivation for you. So here comes another motivation in a seemingly different context. So this is about topological insulators. So Here's another crash course on topological insulators. So these are just, now I live in three dimension. So these are just 3D bulk materials that are insulating. Right? There's no electric conductance inside the bulk. But what's non-trivial about this topological insulator is that on the surface, I have a metal. And moreover, the electrons moving in this surface metal behaves not as ordinary Schrodinger type of particle, but as a massless Dirac fermion. More specifically, this is a two-component Dirac fermion. If you like, you can call it wild, in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And within the theory of free fermions, it's actually quite easy to show that this surface metal is protected in the sense that I cannot easily perturb the surface metal to make it insulating unless I break some important symmetry, in this case, time reversal symmetry. So notice that this is not the case if I have an ordinary two-dimensional, let's say, thin film of metals. Right? So there I can easily make it insulating, let's say, by doping it, smashing it, make it dirty, or tune some parameter. Getting it insulated there is quite easy. But on the surface of a topological insulator, that's not an option. Right? And that's just reflecting the non-triviality of the bulk of a topological insulator. Okay? It's also interesting because it's connected to things like anomalies in quantum field theories and so on. So that's topological insulator, but that's within the free electron theory. So the natural question is what happens with interaction? Right? Or conceptually, we can ask, can we have some crazy interaction? Now let me go beyond the free Dirac fermion, add whatever interaction I want to. And can we have some kind of interaction that makes the surface insulating? I want to kill the metal. Can I do it? While preserving the relevant symmetries, like time reversal symmetry. And it's clear from it's clear that if the interaction is weak, it won't do the job, because you can just do some power counting and conclude that weak interaction is irrelevant, so it doesn't do anything at low energy. So to answer this question, intrinsically, we need to think about strong interaction. But that's also the hard regime. That's the regime where our tool set is very limited. So what do we do with it? Right. So that's another motivation. So now let me go into the actual bulk of my talk. So here's the rough plan. So I'll start with some relatively well-known dualities. I'll start with the extremely well-known duality of electromagnetic dual in Maxwell electrodynamics and move on to what's called the boson vortex duality in 2 plus 1 dimension. Then I'll talk about a fermion generalization of that and application to topological insulators and quantum Hall effect. And I'll further generalize to an entire web of dualities and apply that to questions in quantum criticality. Okay. So now let me begin with something that's probably very familiar. So if I think about Maxwell equation in 3 plus 1 in the vacuum, no charge, no current, this is it. So there is a duality by redefining my electric field as my magnetic field and magnetic field as minus of electric field. You just do this redefinition and the equation remains the same. So it looks like it's merely a choice of which one you call E and which one you call B. Right? Of course, that breaks down once I have some electric charge moving around. Right? But I can restore that by introducing magnetic charge or what's called monopoles, right? So I don't feel too guilty for introducing monopoles conceptually at an institute of theoretical physics. Well, it's a powerful conceptual tool anyway. So Dirac has taught us about a century ago that if quantum mechanics requires the magnetic flux carried by the monopole to be quantized, okay? It's quantized in 2 pi over E. So very roughly, you can think of the monopole as being attached to a flux tube, what's called a Dirac string, which has 2 pi over E flux inside the tube. And when it's 2 pi over E, it's not observable because if I take an electron moving around it, I pick up a phase of 2 pi. And the fact that the constant E appears at the denominator means that if I have weak interaction, let's say a weak Coulomb interaction for my electric charge, then I'll have strong Coulomb interaction between my monopoles. Okay? So sometimes this is also called a strong weak duality. So once I have both electric charge and monopoles, I can restore the notion of EM duality. If I count my electric charge in unit of E and magnetic charge in unit of this flux quanta, then both this little QE and little QM are integers. Now if I try to redefine my electric magnetic fields this way, I can simultaneously redefine my electric and magnetic charge this way. So I call my electric charge magnetic charge, and call my magnetic charge negative of the electric charge, and everything remains the same. Okay? So that's relatively well known. So now let me switch gear and talk about something that looks very different and turn out will be related. Yeah, please.
I have this vague memory that if you introduce magnetic monopoles to electric magnetism, it breaks charge conservation once you take into account relativistic effects.
Sorry, what?
Once you incorporate relativistic effects, you can break charge conservation if you make that modification. It's one of the reasons why people don't like magnetic monopoles.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that statement, but yeah.
But I mean, it would suggest that it's actually a qualitatively different theory from electromagnetism as we observe it in the lab.
Okay.
Charge conservation.
Okay, that's, I'm not familiar with that, but we can talk offline. All right, so now let me actually talk about, to be concrete, imagine a system, an optical lattice, where there are some bosonic atoms hopping on the lattice. And suppose I'm in the regime where, on average, I have one boson per site. Okay, that's a simple system. And depending on the interaction strength between the bosons, there are roughly two limits. So in one limit, where the bosons don't really interact with each other, so they are almost free, then they can just move freely on the lattice. And the ground state is just a Bose-Einstein condensate of the bosons. So it's a superfluid. Well, there's the opposite limit, where the electrons have an extremely strong on-site repulsion, meaning that on each site, it's extremely energetically costly to have two bosons sitting together.
Is that electrons or bosons?
These are bosons. These are atoms. Right. So in that regime, since I have on average one boson per site, the simplest ground state is actually what's called a Mott insulator. It's literally just this picture where I have exactly one boson sitting on each site and they don't move. If I try to move a boson around, necessarily I'll create some sites with double occupancy, and that's costly. Right, so the bosons are basically frozen, and it's called a Mott insulator. It's just an insulator. So what I've described to you are the superfluid and the insulator phases in what's called the particle picture. Right, the superfluid has particles moving around freely. The insulator has particles that are frozen. It turns out I can describe all this in a different picture in terms of quantum vortices. For that, let me start with the superfluid phase. Right? And I consider the superfluid order parameter, phi, which is a complex number. You can roughly think of it as the wave function of the Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay? And there is an object called quantum vortex. It's a point defect in space around which this phase of my order parameter theta winds by 2 pi. Okay? So it's a stable configuration topologically. So in a superfluid ground state, by definition, phi is basically a constant. So of course, this theta is also a constant. It doesn't wind anywhere, meaning that I have no vortex. So I view it as a vacuum of vortices, or insulator of vortices. Okay? So in picture, so this is the particle picture, particles moving around. And in this picture, these arrows represent the phase theta. And because they are perfectly aligned, there's no vortex anywhere. That's very intuitive. What's more interesting is that it turns out the vortex is capable, the vortex picture is capable of describing more. So since these are just reasonable point-like defects or particles, they can move around. And one can see quite easily that if they move around, they behave basically like bosons. Since they are bosons that move around, they are capable, in certain parameter regime, of going into a Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay? So if that happens, that means I have vortices and antivortices coming in and out to my system. As a consequence, the phase theta of the order parameter will fluctuate wildly in space-time. So if I average over some distance, I realize that the order parameter basically vanishes. That's nothing but the Mott insulator phase. So in the vortex picture, a condensate or the superfluid of vortices correspond to just the simple picture in the particle language, where I have exactly one particle sitting on each side. Okay. So to recap, a vortex insulator or vortex vacuum is a particle superfluid, while a vortex superfluid is a particle insulator. So this is the particle vortex duality established way back, I think in the late 70s, early 80s. Of course, the superfluid and the Mott insulator phases are quite simple phases, so it's a little bit overkill to describe it in two languages. But it turns out this duality is useful for other more complicated scenarios. For example, if I want to think about a phase transition between the superfluid and the insulator phase, or if I want to think about more exotic phases, where some of which can be relatively easily described in the vortex picture, while in the particle picture, they seem highly non-trivial, highly counterintuitive. Right? So let me just say that this particle vortex duality is actually related in some subtle way to the electric magnetic duality mentioned earlier. Right? So the way to think about it is to put the electrodynamics with charge and monopoles in a space with a boundary. So this is a three-dimensional space with a two-dimensional boundary. And in the bulk, in the 3D bulk, I can describe the physics either in the electric picture, in which I call my charge, or in the magnetic picture, which I decide to call the monopole charge. I can do it either way. It turns out the surface, the boundary remnant of that is nothing but the charge vortex duality. Very roughly, you can think of the charge, the boundary correspondent of the charge is just the charge, a boson we talk about, the particle, while the boundary remnant of the monopole is really a vortex. Very roughly, you can think of the Dirac string attached to the monopole. When it penetrates through the boundary, it leaves a vortex behind. Okay, these are very rough pictures. It can be made more precise, but okay. One tries to make them precise, there are several cavities that should be filled in. So let me not go into those details. But the picture is roughly this. Okay. And the particle vortex duality can also be cast into some more precise form. If you like nice looking equations, here is one. It's really casting what I said in words into equations. So this is the particle picture where I have a complex boson, interacting boson field. And on the vortex side, I have a complex interacting boson, this little phi, but now coupled with a dynamical U1 gauge field. It's like an artificial photon, right? And the physical meaning of this photon is nothing but the sound wave in the superfluid phase. So for most part of my talk, I don't actually need the actual equation. But it's nice to.
So how would these be related to each other, this little phi and capital phi?
Yeah, so the actual dictionary is a little bit subtle, actually. So this little phi, because it's a gauge non-invariant, it doesn't correspond to a local operator. It corresponds to some non-local operator here, which is just the vortex. The vortex is actually non-local. While the capital phi here actually corresponds to some instanton operator in the side. It's like a defect of this gauge field, little a. Yeah, the actual correspondence is a little bit subtle. Okay, so those are relatively well-established stories. So the EM duality goes back to Maxwell and Dirac. the particle vortex duality goes back to the late 70s and early 80s by Peskin and by Dasgupta and Hopprin. And now let me talk about a more recent duality. It's basically a generalization of this idea as to systems of fermions, or more specifically, Dirac fermions. So for that, I want to actually talk about electric magnetic dualities, but not in the usual context, rather in a topological insulator. But for that, I need to say a little bit more about topological insulator. As I said, the TI is characterized by a surface Dirac fermion. Usually, that's how we characterize it. If we look at the bulk, usually it looks pretty boring. There's nothing there until we put in a monopole, a magnetic monopole, into the bulk. And then there's a famous effect called Witten effect. It's a statement that if I have a magnetic monopole, I have a non-zero QM, necessarily it traps some non-trivial electric charge to it. Okay? For example, if QM equal to 1, so if I have a single monopole, the fundamental monopole, then QE is 1/2. So there is some half integer charge trapped to the monopole. And in some sense, that's probably the most intrinsic characterization of a topological insulator. Okay. What's equally interesting is that if I have a double monopole, so if QM equal to 2, right, naively it looks, okay, it's not a big deal. Now I have QE equal to 1 from this formula. But that I can neutralize by attaching an electron or a hole to it just to cancel the charge. Right? That way I get a completely charge neutral double monopole. But that's actually non-trivial because the electron you attach to it is a fermion. So this process of neutralizing the charge converts the double monopole to a fermion. And this doesn't happen for the usual electrodynamics. In the usual electrodynamics, a double monopole is always a boson. Right? So that's also a non-trivial characterization of a topological insulator. And now we're ready to talk about EM dualities in a topological insulator. For that, it's useful for me to draw what's called the charge monopole lattice. It's just a lattice of all the allowed values of QE and QM, the electric and magnetic charge. So here, this is the lattice for the ordinary electrodynamics, where I have a bosonic charge and bosonic monopole particle. So it's basically just all the integer values for QE and QM. Right? And these blue dots represent bosons. I have boson charge, boson monopole. Red dots represent fermions. I haven't told you why these guys are fermions, but it's not very important for this talk. Okay. And this is the lattice, corresponding lattice for the topological insulator. It's also called a gauge topological insulator because this is really topological insulator coupled to an electrodynamics with monopoles allowed. Okay. This is the lattice. Okay. And this shift from the usual value is just the Witten effect. Now, if I think about the ordinary EM duality, right, QE to QM, QM to minus QE, that in this picture is nothing but a 90-degree rotation of the entire lattice. Right? Now, if you look at this integer lattice, obviously you rotate by 90 degrees, nothing changes. You get the same lattice. Right? It's, that's why we have this electromagnetic duality for the usual electrodynamics. But now, if I try to do that for this lattice, it doesn't work, quite obviously. If I do 90 degree, everything's messed up. This particle goes to somewhere that's originally empty. This particle also goes to somewhere that's originally empty. It's a mess. Right? However, what one could do is you do a 90 degree rotation, and then you rescale the axis. In this case, you rescale the magnetic axis by a factor of 2, and rescale the electric axis by a factor of 1/2. For example, if I take this particle, rotate by 90, and rescale by factor of 2, it goes to here. There is a particle originally there. Or if I take this particle, rotate by 90, and then rescale by 1/2, it goes to this one. And also, you can check that this particle goes to this particle goes to this particle. So everything works out nicely. Okay. So indeed, the bottom line is for the topological insulator, there is a electric magnetic duality, but not the conventional one. It doesn't exchange the electric charge and the single monopole. Rather, it exchanges the electric charge and the double monopole. And that's also consistent with the statistics, because as I have told you, both these guys are fermions. Okay? So they really just exchange. So similar to the bosonic case, remember in the bosonic case, the fact that I can exchange the boson and the monopole translates on the boundary to the fact that I can choose to describe my physics either in terms of the bosonic particle or the bosonic vortex, or the 2-pi vortex. Now I have an electric magnetic duality that allows me to exchange the fermionic charge with a fermionic double monopole. Right? This is a 4-pi monopole, not a 2-pi monopole. So that turns out translates to the boundary as a duality between a charge theory of fermions and a vortex theory also of fermions. Right? And this is not a usual 2-pi vortex, it's a 4-pi vortex because this is a double monopole. Furthermore, I know what the fermions do on the boundary because this is a topological insulator. As I said, we know the fermions on the boundary of a topological insulator behaves like a Dirac fermion. It's a single Dirac cone there. So then I basically get a duality between two theories. One is a charge theory, a particle theory. It's just a Dirac fermion. It's actually simpler than the interacting bosons I talked about before. But then the dual theory, you describe it in terms of a 4-pi vortex, but now the 4-pi vortex is a fermion, and furthermore, it should, by the same logic, be a Dirac fermion, right? So if I write in terms of equations, this is the equation, you know, Lagrangian for the Dirac fermion, and this is the Lagrangian for the Dirac fermion moving as a vortex. Similar to before, this Dirac fermion couples to a dynamical U1 gauge field or a photon field, which if I'm in the superfluid phase, these photon fields are my sound waves, a Goson mode. Okay? So it's a pretty reasonably short and nice looking equation. It's good for just staring at it with a glass of wine in hand on a Sunday afternoon. But what's also amazing is it's actually useful. Now let me we talk about how this can be applied, actually in two different contexts. So the first context, since I essentially formulated everything in terms of topological insulators, let's think about topological insulators a little bit more. Let me go back to the question I posed at the beginning, that can we, by cranking up some kind of strong interaction, make the topological insulator surface insulating? So in the particle picture, it's not clear what to do with it. Right? You add a strong interaction, you can't solve it, what do you do? Well, it turns out we can go to the vortex picture, where the physics is described by Dirac fermions moving as vortices, but not the original particles. Right? And now, let me remind you, in the bosonic particle vortex duality, if I want to get an insulator phase, what I need is a condensate or a superfluid phase for the vortices. That's how I got my Mott insulator in the bosonic system. It turns out that logic also applies here. So if I want to make my TI surface insulating, what I need to do is to bring the vortex fermions, the vortex particles, into a superfluid. But obviously, the vortex, the 4-pi vortices, since they are Dirac fermions, you can't condense a single fermion, but you can condense a pair of them. Right? They can form a Cooper pair, now they are bosons, they can condense to form a superfluid. That's a vortex superfluid, which in the particle picture is just an insulator. This is a cartoon of a pretty bad cartoon of a vortex superfluid. These are the Cooper pair of the vortices, and these are the sound modes. And they interact to get an insulator. But this the insulator you get this way is very different from the Mott insulator I described in the bosonic system. So in the bosonic system, the Mott insulator also has a classical picture where I just put exactly one particle per site. It's a totally classical picture. But such a classical picture doesn't exist for this kind of insulator. So in the modern jargon, these are called some highly entangled many-body topological state. Right? So it doesn't admit a classical description. In fact, it's a non-trivial topological order. And it's so interesting that this topological order has two names. So one name is called T Fafian, the other is called PH Fafian, depending on exactly which context you're talking about them. So it's some non-trivial topological order with non-abelian quasi-particle anions, and so on. And so let me comment that similar results were obtained in other ways several years ago, I think 2013. But there, the argument was much more complicated. Actually, there were several different arguments for similar results, but each of them are so complicated that there's no way to fit them into one slide. But with this duality tool in hand, conceptually at least, this is actually quite a straightforward task. Okay. So what I've told you is mostly a theorist fantasy, because almost most of the actual topological insulators realized in the labs are not that strongly interacting. They still just behave like it's Dirac fermion moving around. Okay. But it turns out this problem of Dirac fermions with strong interaction can actually be mapped to the problem of fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay. So the idea is follows. If I take a Dirac fermion, now I put in a relatively large magnetic field, the Dirac dispersion gets quantized into Landau levels. Right? You just solve the Dirac equation. While for a usual Schrodinger fermion, let's say what you have in a two-dimensional electron gas in a semiconductor, if you put in a magnetic field, you also get similar Landau levels. But the global structure is different. For example, for the Dirac fermion, you get Landau levels all the way down. It's not bounded below. There are many negative energy Landau levels. While for the Schrodinger fermion, there is a lowest Landau level below which there's nothing. Right. So it's actually quite different. But if I focus in the regime where I have energy or temperature much smaller than the gap between the Landau levels, I also have interaction strength much smaller than the gap between the Landau levels, then I just focus on the single partially filled Landau level. I forget about all the completely filled or completely empty ones. Right? And then it doesn't matter. All that global structure doesn't matter. I just look at one Landau level, and they are exactly the same Landau level. Right? So in that regime, these two problems are basically the same problem, which means whatever fancy, crazy topological order I can realize on this topological insulator surface can also, in principle, be realized in an actual quantum Hall system, in an actual gallium-arsenide, aluminum-arsenide heterostructure with magnetic field and so on. Right? And in fact, this PH-Fafian topological order I just talked about is one of the candidate state at this Feeling fraction 5/2. This is the Feeling fraction I emphasized at the beginning of the talk. And it's allegedly a different proposal from most of the previous proposed states. It's a different topological order. So how do we, so it's a different candidate for the 5/2 state, but can we tell somehow that whether it's a better candidate in any sense? Well, it comes with a measurable consequence. So the PH-Fafian predict that the thermal Hall conductance is 5/2 in the natural unit, as opposed to 7/2 for the Fafian state or 3/2 for the anti-Fafian state. And this is pretty much what's been measured from last year's thermal Hall conductance measurement. So it agrees with the experiment, if you can tolerate some the error bars there. So it's also supported by some other less direct experimental evidences. So it does seem likely that even though we started the discussion with some outlandish argument about interacting topological insulators, they're funny vortices, I have to make them superfluid, get a weird topological order. But maybe at the end of the day, this is what's been realized in an actual piece of solid. Right? So that's rewarding. It doesn't mean that the issue is completely settled. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Because if you really think about it, there is an issue, because the numerical simulation in the past two decades, basically, actually doesn't say that at the 5/2 you should get a PH-Fafian state. Predominantly, the Fafian or the anti-Fafian states I mentioned before seem to be the energetically favored ones. So that's in tension with the thermal hall conductance measurement. Right? So you know, the question is what's going on? In fact, that question is not completely understood now. So there is one possibility that, because in the real samples, there are always some disorders. Right? There's some dirt around. And, but in the numerical simulation, nobody include the disorder, because it's just too hard. So it's possible that the disorder, through some mechanism, may actually stabilize or induce this pH Fafian order, even though in the clean limit, it's a different thing. It's a Fafian or anti-Fafian. So there are some proposals, several proposals of this along this line, one from us. But I would say that this issue is still not fully understood. Okay? It's actually an open issue of exactly how this could happen or whether this is really the right way to resolve the issue. But independent of this, one can ask a more general question. Right? It's the classic strategy of if I don't know how to solve the question, let me generalize the question. So the general question is, could disorder somehow change the story of the standard story of topological orders in some interesting way? The standard, usually what happens is if I have a topological order and I introduce some disorder to it, either it doesn't do anything. If it's weak, it doesn't do anything. That's why topological orders are stable. They're interesting. Or it just, if it's too strong, it just completely ruins everything. It destroys the topological order. It's a mess, right? Question is, can you do something more interesting? And this may be an example where disorder can do something more interesting, but it's not fully understood. It's a very reasonable future question. So, yes?
Before you proceed, isn't it supposed that for you to see the fractional quantum Hall effect, you need very clean samples? No disorder at all?
No, that's not true. You need very clean samples, but not absolutely clean. If it's okay. Absolutely clean, then you have to sit exactly at the Fini fraction, let's say 5 half,
okay,
to see the physics, which nobody can do that. So with some disorder, you get some plateau. Without disorder, you don't get plateau, that's the thing. But if disorder is too strong, you also don't get the plateau. So yeah, it's actually a tricky issue. So, so now I've talked about the dualities between two theories of bosons and the duality between two theories of fermions. It turns out they can be generalized to an entire what's called web of dualities. We call it web because many of these dualities are related intimately to each other. There are essentially infinitely many of these. And turns out they have some very interesting applications to a certain quantum phase transition. I'll be quite brief on this part. So remember, for both the boson and Dirac fermion particle vortex duality, I motivated with the electric magnetic duality. It turns out there are infinitely many different varieties of EM dualities. And each one motivates a different duality in 2 plus 1 dimension. Okay? Some of them relates theory of fermions to theory of bosons. So here is an example. It's a fermion boson duality, sometimes also misleadingly called 2 plus 1 debosonization. So the rough idea is if I think about the electrodynamics now with a theory, with my charge being a fermion, but my monopole being a boson, I can still think about the operation of exchanging my charge and fermion. My charge and monopole. I can still decide to call whichever one my real charge. Of course, that doesn't leave the theory invariant, but it's still a perfectly fine electromagnetic electrodynamics theory. Right? If I have a bosonic charge and fermionic monopole, there's nothing wrong with it. Right? So that operation actually motivates a duality on the surface, where in the charge picture, I have a Dirac fermion, and in the vortex picture, which corresponds to the monopoles, I have a theory of bosons. But now this theory of bosons, again, they are some kind of vortices, so they couple to some photon field, it's a little a. But there's an additional Chern-Simons term for this gauge field, little a. I'm not going to tell you exactly why it should be there. But basically, the statement is this. These two theories are due. So this duality is interesting on its own. It's also related to some version of dualities in this supersymmetric quantum field theory literature. So now we have essentially an infinite set of dualities. There are many games one can play with it. And one can, of course, optimistically hope that some of these dualities must be useful for some many-body problems. And that is true. So let me briefly say that the duality can be applied in the context of quantum phase transitions, at least in two ways. We've learned at least two lessons from it. One lesson is that there are some phase transitions that are seemingly very different. Actually, people studied them separately for quite some time. But they're secretly the same. They're due to each other. So that's one. That's a perk that reduced the number of unsolved questions by two, by a factor of two, even though it didn't actually solve any one of them. So. But we also learned some non-trivial lesson out of it, because sometimes it happens that the transition one has some obvious global symmetry G1. That's easy to see. Just write down the Lagrangian, it's obvious there. Right? While the second transition also has an obvious Lagrangian, obvious symmetry. Right? Write down the Lagrangian, there's a symmetry there. But the two, the G1, G2, they don't have to be the same. But if they are indeed dual, and they meaning they flow in a renormalization group sense to the same fixed point, so they have the same long distance, low energy physics, then the actual fixed point, the actual low energy physics, must have an enhanced symmetry G that contains both G1 and G2 as a subgroup. Okay? So this is a non-perturbative mechanism to obtain emergent symmetries at critical points. Sometimes this emergent symmetries can also be seen in some perturbative way, but there are examples where we have no idea how to see it from perturbation theory. This is the only way we know how to see understand the emergent symmetry. And this has been applied to a class of transition called deconfined quantum critical points. These are transitions on a quantum lattice magnets, let's say a transition between an antiferromagnet magnet, where the spins order up, down fashion, and another phase, which is paramagnet, but breaks a certain lattice symmetry. So there, at the critical point, numerically, people observed some enhanced symmetry, which was considered mysterious. But with the duality tool, it can be explained quite straightforwardly. Okay. So on the frontier of the, similar to the topological order case, on the frontier of the quantum phase transition, there are also lots of unresolved issues. Some of them are more directly related to the duality story I told you. Some of them are more indirectly motivated by some of the recent developments. For example, as I said, in the topological order case, there is some tension between numerics and experiments, and here, there are tension between numerics and numerics. In particular, the Monte Carlo simulation and the conformal bootstrap result, there's some tension there. It's unclear exactly how to resolve them. There are some proposals, but none of them are fully understood at this point. There are also other issues. One can also ask, similar to the topological order case, what about the effect of disorder? This is a fairly old question. The effect of disorder on quantum phase transitions. It's old, and it's very difficult. It's not so much is understood. But it's also extremely relevant for experimental systems, for example, superconductor insulator transitions or fractional quantum Hall transitions. And one can legitimately ask, could the new tool set, the expanded tool set of duality be helpful there? And these are all open questions that should be resolved. So with that, let me just, this is the summary and end here. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, about your last slide, where you're talking about these dualities that can help you to understand some unconventional physics size scale in phase transitions. Have you found any example where these dualities can help you to understand these unconventional physics size scaling when you have a longer range interactions in phase transitions?
We haven't thought about long range interaction. Oh. It's a valid question, but we just haven't thought. Yeah, it's a good question.
It would be useful.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's conceivable uh-huh. that there would be some examples where adding the effect of long-range interaction may be more manageable on one side of the duality than the other.
Uh-huh.
It's conceivable, but we haven't thought very carefully.
Thank you.
So is the pH-Fafian state expected to have non-abelian anions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The non-abelian part is basically, it's very similar to what you have for Fafian and anti-Fafian.
Okay.
The difference are mostly in the abelian part. That's why it's more subtle to distinguish.
I see.
So I think in your definition of duality, if I remember correctly, you said that you have two different theories that they flow to the same infrared.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now the part that is hard for me to understand is, I mean, of course, the two different theories have different language. You're talking about different degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
So how do you want to compare them in the infrared? I mean, what's
right?
One?
So they flow to the same fixed point, and that to establish such a thing, we also need an operator dictionary.
Yeah.
So we need to know. The operator on one side corresponds to what operator on the other side? That we usually have. I mean, I didn't talk about that because they tend to be a little bit.
But then, if you do have the operator dictionary, then it has nothing to do with infrared versus UV. That should be. I mean, the dictionary works at all energies, shouldn't it?
Not in terms of dynamics. Right? For example, when you go to the infrared, the it's more relevant if it's some strongly correlated, let's say, critical. Point, right? In the infrared, you can talk about scaling dimensions and so on. So if they are dual, they should have the same scaling dimension, but not necessarily in the UV. Depending on how you define it, right? That if you define the usual renormalizable continuum field theory language, then in the UV, they are basically free theories. The dimensions are all trivial, and there you can explicitly see that the operators that are supposed to be dual to each other do not have the same scaling dimension in the UV. Right, so that could happen. Right? So dynamical property, they could differ. But the typical global structures, like the symmetries they carry and so on, usually that's the same in IR, UV, and that they should match. Yeah.
So then in your definition of duality, this dictionary, it doesn't work at all energies. Is that true? Or?
No, some aspect of it doesn't
some
work.
Some aspects of it doesn't work.
Yeah. For example, scaling dimension. Something that that's related to dynamics. Yeah. There are some more robust structures like anomalies and so on that works at any scale. But yeah.
But like for the simple example, you started with this electric magnetic duality. That works at all energy.
Yeah. That's a free theory. So
right.
Yeah. That's a special example. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Do we have any other questions? If not, I'll let Sam Chong in.